if we're honest, we will look into the mirror and see what the truth is, and see what the truth is, and see what the truth is.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised.
It will be podcast.
Welcome to the No Illusions Podcast for Friday, August 19th, 2011. This is Cameron Riley. Welcome back to the show. It's been a while. I've been overseas for a month, been in the USA where I got married to my lovely bride, Christine, and hired a car and basically drove around the US, did about 12,000 miles, went to four national parks, Grand Canyon, Yosemite National Park, Bryce Canyon, and Zion National Park. Went to Area 51, went to Las Vegas, went to LA. We did quite a bit. Anyway, you don't care about any of that stuff. This is the show where we talk about the news, the real news behind the news, and got a couple of good stories that I've been collecting over the last couple of weeks that thought I'd share with you, mostly over the last week, actually, so it's all pretty recent. Interesting versions of world events and what's going on. Here's one that surprised me. I got this out of Foreign Policy magazine, which if you don't read, it's a really good read. And in fact, you can read it on the iPad if you have one of those. It's available via the Zinio app. It's a bit expensive. It's about $8 an issue, but some of the best journalism I've found talking about world events and what's going on. This is by Joshua Goldstein. The article's called World Peace Could Be Closer Than You Think. And it starts off with the premise that the world is a more violent place than it used to be. He says, no way. The early 21st century seems awash in wars. The conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, street battles in Somalia, Islamist insurgencies in Pakistan, massacres in the Congo, genocidal campaigns in Sudan. All in all, regular fighting is taking place in 18 wars around the globe today. Public opinion reflects this sense of an ever more dangerous world. One survey a few years ago found that 60% of Americans considered a third world war likely. But then he goes on to say that the last decade has seen fewer war deaths than any decade in the past 100 years. Based on data compiled by researchers from the Peace Research Institute in Oslo, worldwide, deaths caused directly by war-related violence in the new century have averaged about 55,000 per year, just over half of what they were in the 1990s, 100,000 a year, and a third of what they were during the Cold War, 180,000 a year from 1950 to 1989, and a hundredth of what they were in World War II. Now, if you factor in the growing global population, which has nearly quadrupled in the last century, the decrease is even sharper. Far from being an age of killer anarchy, the 20 years since the Cold War ended have been an era of rapid progress towards peace. Now, this is certainly interesting. It certainly surprised me when I read it. It's not something that I'd given much thought to. And it'd be interesting to think about the reasons behind this. Be interesting to look at where the deaths came from in previous decades and how much of it was colonial expansion. Obviously, if we look in the... Let's leave World War II out of it because that's fairly obvious. One of the things that people don't often realise, though, about World War II is how many deaths occurred on the Eastern Front, Germany's push into Russia. There was tens of millions of Russians alone who died during that just a few years of Germany's push up there. But if you look at the post-World War II war deaths, a lot of them are probably going to be involved in imperialist expansion around the world when the US and its allies, declared or undeclared, were pushing into Asia, were pushing into the Middle East, were pushing into South America, and you had, you know, what seemed to be an endless series of coups, civil wars in all of those regions that were, again, directly or indirectly funded in large part by the United States, sometimes by England, sometimes by France, But the majority in the 20th century, and of course the Soviet Union as well, although I think the Soviet Union had more problems at home during the late 20th century than they caused in other places. I mean, a lot of deaths in the Soviet Union during that period, partly as a result of the devastation they suffered during World War II in the Eastern Front, as I mentioned, partly as a result of famine that was caused, you know, in part by climactic events and partly due to Stalin's attempt to rapidly modernize Russia, which caused massive chaos and economic upheaval, and partly, of course, because Stalin, in particular, was a complete dickhead, a murderous, violent dickhead, which, by the way, had nothing to do with him being a communist. There's nothing in communism, in the Communist Manifesto, that says you have to be a violent, murderous dickhead. That was Bolshevism. It was in part Leninism and mostly Stalinism that led to this violent oppression. Now, you know, go read the Communist Manifesto or any of the writings of Marx or Engels and tell me where it supports violence. It doesn't support violence at all. Anyway, that's an interesting article and something that's worth thinking about. So in part, maybe it's because the world is already run now by the US. They have this massive global military infrastructure that means that most of these countries around the world that experienced a lot of violence in the late 20th century are now well in control and run by US dictators, which leads me to the second article that I found fascinating in the last couple of days. This came out again in Foreign Policy magazine. It's called The Empire at Dusk. It's by Stephen Glain, G-L-A-I-N. It says, American pundits decry the onset of sharp defense cuts, but the Pentagon can't even account for $1 trillion in its own spending. Isn't it time to rein in the beast? I won't read the whole article, but there's some really interesting quotes that I got out of here. Here's the first one. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, U.S. presidents have ordered troops into battle 22 times compared with 14 times during the Cold War, and not once did they appeal to lawmakers for a declaration of war. The legacy of American militarism is a national security complex that thrives on fraud, falsehood, and deception. In the 1950s, Americans were told the Soviets had not only the means to destroy the United States, but the desire to do so. In reality, Moscow lacked the former and so gave little thought to the latter, while Washington squandered billions of dollars on needless weaponry. Time and again, U.S. presidents weaponized their response to challenges overseas to protect them from charges of appeasement from the right. Habitually, their administrations misinterpreted events, from Russia's Bolshevik Revolution to the September 11th attacks, to disastrous effect. In each case, expert advice was overlooked, ignored, or concealed, while in others, threats were manufactured as chips and petty political wages. The fraudulent bomber and missile gaps and the Gulf of Tonkin incident did as much to injure U.S. interests overseas as did the notion that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and intended to use them preemptively. Only a country so rich in resources and blessed by favorable geography could afford such malfeasance. America has been spared foreign invasion for more than 200 years, and it can expect to remain inviolate for centuries to come. Just stopping there for a second, that's a good point that people often forget. I mean, you look at the devastation that was caused on Europe and England and their peoples by World War I and World War II, because, you know, they were in the heart of it. The US was sitting by itself in the middle of the ocean and, you know, didn't have any direct attacks, unless you include Pearl Harbor, which you really shouldn't, during that period. So all of the millions and millions of European civilians, men in particular, working age men, the economic base of their countries during that period, were wiped out. Didn't happen in the US. Whilst they lost some soldiers, obviously, during World War II in particular, the majority of their civilian infrastructure wasn't touched. whereas in Europe it was completely destroyed. And that's the main reason the US came out on top post-World War II. Anyway, the article continues, yet each year it spends enough money on national security to match the economic output of Indonesia, with money borrowed largely from China, a country with which it is preparing for conflict. It insists on its right to launch a preemptive nuclear attack against such countries as North Korea and Iran, oafish bankrupt regimes that seek a complement of atomic bombs because they're surrounded by countries with bunkers full of them. So, really interesting article that I suggest you read it. I mean, again, this is not in some conspiracy theory mag. It's in Foreign Policy magazine, foreignpolicy.com, if you're looking for it online. Very well written article. There's another quote here I wanted to grab for you. I'm just pulling up the rest of the article. Bear with me while I'm smoking a Podomo Lot 23 Punta Gorda. My internet's dodgy. Oh, here it comes. Dum da dum da dum. Talk amongst yourselves. Talk amongst yourselves. Here we go. If the Pentagon were a corporation, it would be the largest in the world, as well as the most sloppily run. Its procurement budget, at a staggering $107 billion in 2010, that's just its procurement budget, expands even as the number of deployable warplanes, combat ships and troops diminishes. To entice lawmakers into approving costly weapons programs, the Pentagon dangles the prospect of jobs in the states and districts of key lawmakers, a costly way of manufacturing, but an astute political maneuver. Waste, inefficiency, and political patronage, no stranger to military legislative affairs, get more lavish by the year. In April 2008, the Government Accountability Office found that 95 major Pentagon projects exceeded their original budgets by a total of nearly $300 billion. A year later, it concluded that nothing had changed. In 2009, lawmakers larded the Pentagon's annual budget proposal with nearly $5 billion in programs and weapons it didn't request. With arms factories scattered like feeding troughs nationwide, America has become the equivalent of a company town with the Pentagon as primary employer. Where's the stuff about the money going missing? Just going to the next page. I hate it when websites spread articles out over multiple web pages, by the way. I just got to say, it drives me nuts. Can't you put it just on one page? I can scroll. I know how to scroll. Well, I can't find the bit about the $3 trillion. Must have been earlier in the article. But basically, what it says, they did an audit and found that there was basically $1 trillion of spending by the Pentagon that it can't account for. It can't find it. Doesn't know where it went. $1 trillion, ladies and gentlemen, disappeared. And, you know, we know what kind of financial problems the US is in. But, you know, oh, here we go. I found it. In an October 2009 report, the Defense Department's Inspector General exposed more than a dozen significant deficiencies in Pentagon balance sheets from fiscal years 2004 to 2008. Mining opaque audit trails and murky contracting systems, the report uncovered more than $1 trillion in unsupported account entries. In September 2010, the Senate Finance Committee issued a report that slammed the Pentagon's total lack of fiscal accountability for leaving huge sums of the taxpayers' money vulnerable to fraud and outright theft. So 2004 to 2008, obviously when the Bush regime were running things in the US, $1 trillion goes missing from the Pentagon alone. Now, this is where we find the real reason that anyone wants to be president and their friends want them to be president. You become president, you get to run these sorts of organizations like the Pentagon, you and your lackeys, and you can make $1 trillion disappear. Where do you think it went to? Where did that $1 trillion go? This is just part of the rot that's going on in the US. It's built into the system. It's, on one hand, absolutely genius. But I don't know why the American people put up with it, you know. And then, of course, Obama gets in. Does he, you know, bring any of these people up on charges? Do they do any serious investigations, inquiries? Are there any charges laid for fraud, theft of this money? No, of course not. Why? Because he works for the same guys. Goldman Sachs were the largest or second largest investor in his corporate campaign. Election campaign, I mean, the second largest corporate investor in his election campaign. And, you know, all the same guys are being covered. So, you know, we just see time and time again that the system just continues to protect its own. And the American taxpayer, the American people, are getting defrauded hand over fist, and, you know, they do nothing about it. So that's really what American politics is all about. You know, it was quite comical when I was over there for the last month with Chrissy, just watching the ramp up to the 2012 election campaign. Can you believe it's like 15 months out from their actual presidential elections? And all of the news coverage over there, 24 hours a day, is talking about the presidential primaries, the Republican primaries. It is just an absolute circus. It's just designed to suck up billions and billions of dollars in campaign funding. It's designed to keep the population distracted. It's designed to give the population the illusion that they have choice, that you know, they get to choose who's going to lead them. It's just entertainment. Politics has become entertainment in the United States. And, you know, you contrast that with Australia, where we normally find out we're going to have a federal election about 3 weeks before it happens. Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, done and dusted, let's get on with life. Over there, it's an 18-month process. And, you know, $500 billion, I think they're saying that there's going to be $1 billion in campaign funding, they think, this year. It's going to be ridiculous. Anyway, this is why they spend that kind of money on election campaigns. It's because there's big money for the winners. You know, the $1 trillion that went missing during the Bush era is just one example. Obviously, you know, you look at the way the financial system's being frauded constantly over there. Collapses, bailouts, followed by massive profits, followed by more collapses and bailouts, and then more massive profits. It's just an endless cycle where a very, very small percentage of the population are raping and pillaging the rest of the population. And no one seems to give a shit. You know, even the Tea Parties, we know the Tea Party is a big joke. The Tea Party's being funded by the Koch brothers and Murdoch, who are two of the biggest benefactors of the whole rort and fraud system. So they've tapped into this genuine angst that the American population has, but they're distracting them. They're pointing them in the wrong direction. Umair Haque. I never know how to pronounce Umair's name. I should ask him. Umairhaque, the director of the Harvest Media Lab, and wrote a great article for the Harvest Business Review about what's going on in London, where he's from. You know, the whole London riots thing happened when I was overseas, and I followed it as closely as I could while I was on the road. What really strikes me about the whole London riot situation is, if these riots were happening in Egypt or Syria or Libya, you know, the media and American governments would be referring to it as, you know, the Arab Spring, the Middle Eastern Spring, the rise of the people against an oppressive regime. But it happens in a developed country like England, and it's written off as a bunch of hoodlums that are just looting and being violent. And no one's looking at the root cause. Well, some people are, not enough people. Umar wrote a really good article that I wish I'd written myself. I started to write something like this on my blog while I was away, but he was much more eloquent than I could be. It says, underneath the surface chatter about police brutality and parental responsibility is a deeper fear, and a not unfounded one, that a social contract's been torn up. If you accept the possibility that there are many kinds of violence, not merely physical, but emotional, economic, financial, and social, to name just a few, then perhaps the social contract being offered by today's polities goes something like this. Some kinds of violence are more punishable than others. Blow up the financial system? Here's a state-subsidised bonus. Steal a video game? You're toast. There are many kinds of looting. There's looting your local superstore, and then there's, as Nobel laureates Akerlof and Romer discussed in a paper now famous among geeks, there's looting a bank, a financial system, a corporation, or an entire economy. Their paper might be crudely summed up in the pithy line, the best way to rob a bank is to own one. The bedrock of an enlightened social contract is, crudely, that rent-seeking is punished and creating enduring, lasting, shared wealth is rewarded, and that those who seek to profit by extraction are chastened rather than lauded. Today's world of bailouts, golden parachutes, sky-high financial sector salaries, while middle incomes stagnate, seems to be exactly the reverse. Perhaps that our societies have reached a natural turning point of built-in self-limitation, and this self-limitation is causing a perfect storm to converge. An enlightened social contract is not built on subsidies or handouts, whether to the impoverished or to the pitiable welfare junkies formerly known as the markets. It's built on a calculus of harm and benefit, not just accepted by a plurality of its citizens, but also a calculus that can be said to be meaningful in the sense that it results in real human prosperity. Without such a bargain to set incentives and coordinate economic activity, even the mightiest, proudest societies will find themselves as bent old men on an endless plateau, searching for a lick of shelter as the typhoon bears down. So basically what he seems to be saying, and I totally agree, is that in the Western developed countries such as the UK, the United States and Australia to a somewhat lesser extent, the social contract is being distorted. You have a very small percentage of the population that are raping and pillaging, as I said earlier, and basically leaving everyone else to fend for themselves. Now, that's not going to work long term. This isn't a sustainable model for a healthy society. And, you know, I guess one of the things that changed my political view when I was in my late 20s and early 30s from being right-wing, which I was in my 20s, to probably what we would consider left-wing, although I don't really consider myself either. I mean, if people ask me what my political viewpoint is today, I say I'm all about whatever it takes to build a sustainable, prosperous, humane, just world. I don't belong to any camp. I'm looking for the rules, the laws, the mechanics for building a prosperous, sustainable world, just, fair, harmonious world. But it struck me from reading I was doing during that period that if we end up with a society where you have a small percentage of people that are wealthy and the rest of people are struggling, it's not going to be a sustainable world even for the wealthy. They may have the houses and the cars and the bank accounts and the yachts and the planes and the bling, but they're going to find themselves like Louis the 16th did and Marie Antoinette at the dawn of the French Revolution. If you piss off the people, you're just going to be faced with an untenable situation. There was no good being King Louis when the revolution happened. People were just starving, pissed off, disenfranchised enough that they, you know, cut off his head and his wife's head. So if you're one of the wealthy conservative elite, you need to think seriously about that. Is this the world that you want to build? And it's not just true for your country. Obviously, what we're seeing happen in London right now is a complete fracturing of some elements of society. But it also is true on a global basis. If you have a couple of countries that are extremely wealthy and they leave the rest of the world to rot, particularly if they have gained their wealth and maintained their wealth by the deliberate exploitation of lesser countries or countries that aren't as economically developed, and they continue to oppress those people and steal their resources and support dictators to keep them oppressed and support economic policies to keep their people poor, eventually it's going to come back and bite you on the ass. I mean, you can kind of look at 9/11 that way. I do. I think the cause of the... I mean, well, for a start, I'm not convinced that Al-Qaeda or Islamic terrorists were responsible for the 9/11 attacks. I haven't seen sufficient evidence to remove all doubt about who was responsible for that. We've only got the word of the CIA or the FBI and the US government at the time, and I don't trust any of those. They're the biggest terrorist organizations on the planet, so I don't take what they say at face value. I'd want to see evidence. But let's say it was Islamic terrorists that caused 9/11. Did they have a point? Have their people been constantly attacked and oppressed by the West and the United States in particular for the last 100 years? Absolutely. Do they have a reason to want revenge? Absolutely. And what happened? You know, they attacked the US in 2001. 10 years later, is the US better off or worse off than it was in 1991? I think worse off, most people would agree. It's an absolute basket case. Economically, obviously. Politically, obviously. In terms of its human rights record, definitely. In terms of its public perception around the world, absolutely. In terms of the basic human rights and the lifestyle that its citizens have, absolutely. So this is the cats coming home to roost. Is that what it says? Chickens. Cats don't roost. They chase roosters. This is the chickens coming home to roost. If you oppress the people of the world, they will come and eventually they're going to work out how to come back and bite you on the ass. So it just doesn't make it. It's not in our own best interests to try and maintain wealth in one country while everyone else is starving or living in hovels. I don't care how much Ayn Rand you've read, and I'm a big fan of Ayn Rand, as long-time listeners will know. It doesn't matter how much you believe that might makes right or how much you believe that your own hard work and effort is what has made you wealthy. See, this is a fallacy as well. You know, if you're a conservative white male business person living in Australia or the US or the UK, and you know, you've built your business, you've made your money, and you feel like you deserve to keep it because you did it all by yourself. This is how I used to think in my late 20s. But that's not the whole story. If there weren't people collecting the garbage, sweeping the streets, growing the food, working at McDonald's, making sure that the water and the electricity were flowing, you wouldn't be able to do what you do. If you needed to grow or hunt your own food, prepare your own food, if you needed to dig your own waste latrines and get rid of your own waste products, if you needed to clean your own roads, if you needed to build your own form of transport, if you needed to do all of those things yourself, you wouldn't have the time or the energy to do your business, to build your business that created the wealth for you in the first place. No man is an island, as somebody I can't recall, some famous philosopher once said. We live in a society, and I don't care how much you think you are solely responsible for your own success. It's bullshit. If it wasn't for the infrastructure of the society around you, you wouldn't be able to do what you do. And so therefore, it's in your own best interests to build that society, to make sure it's functioning and healthy and sustainable. And not only for those reasons. I mean, you don't know where the next cure for cancer is going to come from. You don't know. There could be a kid out there who has unemployed parents. And if that kid may have the genius potential to solve one of the world's big problems, but if they don't get a good education and they don't have sufficient health care, then they may not be that person that solves cancer, that you may need that cure. You know, the more kids that we have that are getting a good education, that have good health care, the more effective our society is going to be. And by the way, this extends to asylum seekers, or what get referred to in Australia as boat people now, or illegals, illegal immigrants. They're asylum seekers. You know, if we bring those people into our country, give them a safe haven, get their children into our schools, into our healthcare system, there's very good potential that 20 years from now, those kids are going to be significant contributors to our economy and to our society. It makes us a stronger, healthier country. Yes, we need to look at resource management, we need to look at economic management, all of those things, but, you know, we're a very, very wealthy, prosperous country. We can afford to do that. Not to mention that we have a legal obligation under the UN Charter to accept asylum seekers. That's another issue. There's a moral and ethical issue there as well. But I'm talking about purely selfish incentives to bring these people in and give them the advantage of an education, give them an advantage of healthcare, and to turn them into contributing members of our society. These are good things for us to do. These are selfish. There are selfish reasons to want to do that. It's not about having a charity mentality or a welfare mentality. There are purely selfish reasons for wanting to do that. Final story, just getting back to the US before I go. How much time have I got left here? What am I doing? How am I talking for? Half an hour. That'll do. Don't know where I got this story from. Obama's war on whistleblowers suffers setback by Ash Pemberton. Says that despite his election promises, the treatment of whistleblowers in the US under Obama is actually worse than it was under previous administrations. I'm looking for the right quote here. Blah 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 blah. Can't find the quote. Oh, here we go. Yeah. No, that's not it. There's a broader attack, it says, by the Obama administration on the public's right to know what governments do behind closed doors. It talks about Bradley Manning and his treatment. It talks about Thomas Drake, who leaked information that exposed corruption, serious waste, and possible criminal activity at the National Security Agency, facing 35 years jail. Oh, here's a good quote. The U.S. government has continued to block the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendez, from holding a private meeting with Bradley Manning. Mendez said, "It is imperative that I talk to Mr. Manning under conditions where I can be assured that he is being absolutely candid." Manning has been held without trial since May last year for allegedly leaking thousands of secret U.S. government documents to media outlet WikiLeaks. Just more evidence that the current U.S. administration is just as malevolent towards freedom of information and towards people suspected of blowing the whistle on the corruption and the fraud that's being perpetrated by the US government than previous administrations were. You know, this is for you know, the people who continue to be supporters of the Democrats and of Obama in the US. Got to realize that he's playing the same game and just playing it harder in many ways than even previous administrations were, and can't be supported. If you're a believer in transparent government, if you're a believer in democracy, if you're a believer in justice and human rights, you can't call yourself a Democrat. You have to find an alternative political party or representatives, independents to support over there. You need to build a new political system. If you continue to think of yourself as a Democrat and to support the Democrats, you're basically just entrenching the current state of corruption over there, because at the end of the day, they're all run by the same interests. All right, well, this is the show for today. Thanks to those of you who are listening. Send me any feedback on Twitter, Cameron Riley on Twitter, cameronriley@gmail.com. If you send me an email, I'm on Skype @CameronRiley. Love to get your thoughts. Love to get your ideas. If you disagree with something I said, tell me and we can talk about it. At the end of the day, this is just my attempt to try and figure out how does the world work and what do we need to do to build a sustainable, prosperous, fair, harmonious world for everyone. This is Cameron out.